Welcome to Beetle Blethers with Jerry Hassan and Alan McClure. Hi folks, welcome back to part two of our deep-ish dive into Rubber Soul. We hope you've enjoyed the first part and do please let us know. This episode looks at side two and then looks at the way the album as a whole may have affected popular culture, but there's always more to be said and you may want to say it. Don't be shy, we do have a Facebook page that you can probably find and join that may or may not turn into something. In the meantime, enjoy episode two or episode 1B, whichever you prefer, and we'll see you next time. Thanks, folks. Bye.
Good to go to the first track on side two.
Okay.
And this is one we were just talking about earlier as well. And What Goes On. Of course, What Goes On famously is pretty sure this is the only example in the Beatles canon of a Lennon-McCartney-Starkey composition.
Did any of the... Because Peter Jackson attributed every tiny wee scrap that was in the Let Get Back film to them. And I think there were one or two where Ringo got a credit that he hadn't had before. But I think that was probably all four of them, was it?
Because like, there's tracks that are all four of them.
Yes,
like
Flying. One.
Yeah.
So yes, asked about his contribution in an interview later that year, he said, about four words, and I haven't done anything since.
if that was true, which it could be, Lennon and McCartney weren't exactly known for their generosity and sharing around the composition credits, were they?
Definitely.
Mal Evans, Al Donovan, you
several
know.
Several folk, yes.
Mike Love.
Yeah, for sure, that's right. But they loved Ringo. You know, that's, I think they'd have been delighted to get him something on there because George had a few writing credits by that point and it did up the income. I don't know if people generally recognise. You know, the four Beatles were not earning the same from what they were doing.
Yeah.
Paul and John had by far, because they had the songwriting royalties. Ringo and George did have a percentage of the songwriting royalties. Did they have about 1% each of Northern
it's
Songs? Almost,
it's not as bad as the Smiths were, you know.
A writing credit was lucrative at the time. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
I always skipped over this one in the past, I must confess. Today's the first day that I've just thought, I love this.
I think
I know Ringo better than I did in the past, you know, because I've read more about them and recognise how important he was.
Yeah.
And part of his joyfulness is his love of country music, which is storytelling, good time music. It's sing around the piano with your auntie music. And the Beatles would have been a lesser band without that element, I think, without that genuine grassroots, genuine. This is not faux populism. This is literally where we are from. We used to sing country songs together at home. I mean, I didn't, obviously, but, you know, Ringo and his family did.
Yeah.
And so this is it. This is come on then, join. Come on. It's like, come on.
I think this is the week there's a new Ringo biography out by Tom Doyle. And it is true in the way opinion changes. Every year, Ringo is getting more and more appreciated.
Yes, yeah.
There used to be that crack that he wasn't even the best drummer in the Beatles,
yes.
Which... It's just a scurrilous comment, you know.
Yes.
He's not only the best drummer in the Beatles, he's one of the best drummers in the world.
For sure, envied by drummers.
And he's also, as you know, we're going to do Ringo as a separate programme, so we won't get into this too much, but he's absolutely like the last missing ingredient that makes them the Fab Four.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And so he should get his place. And I this is just a charming, slight throwaway track to me, but it is charming.
Yes, and in the... balance of an album, every track can't be momentous.
I think
about an album like OK Computer, for example, is momentous track after momentous track by Radiohead. They don't know the value of a throwaway track.
Joy Division is closer.
Right, okay.
These are albums that kind of exhaust you.
Yes, right. So it's not a wasted 2 minutes. It's great. It's just, it's like a palate cleanser as well, isn't it? And crucially, where does it go from What Goes On? Where do we go from there?
We go to, yes, Girl.
Which is, we go from this... jolly knees up, diddle diddle diddle, what was on in your eye?
I know.
To this dark, dark reflection on obsession and control and manipulation in a relationship. Not your standard pop fodder at all. Possibly the one lyrically that's most different in this album from previous work. This is really bleak, you know. Was she told when she was young that pain would lead to pleasure? Did she understand it when they said that a man must break his back to before today to earn his day of leisure, will she still believe when he's dead? You know, this is. But it reminded me today, listening of it, it's a bit like some Spanish cantons. You know, the corazones, very melodramatic, but it in that context, you don't. It sounds like he means it, doesn't it? Yeah. He's so. I think he was committed to that song, John. It's a John song, of course, if folk don't know. He came to claim that the character in the song was a kind of mythic mother stroke lover figure who would later be embodied by Yoko.
That's right.
I think. So he certainly felt that one, even when he was looking back and kind of drawing a red line through all his previous work, that one he still had time for. And it's so beautifully done, that. The intake of breath and the...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And there's... Actually, with this and Lennon's other magnum opus on the side, to be fair, words kind of fail me in it because I think they're so magnificent. There's the way it's recorded to get that. There's little techniques they do so they can get to emphasise his breath and thus intimacy about the subject. And it is, you know, everything about that, given it's 1965 and technology, is just staggering.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, words fail me.
It is just... I mean, it is... It's just phenomenal. I'm going to propose later on, in fact, I'll propose now, if the Beatles had ended their career here with Rubber Soul, they would still be remembered.
Yeah, of course.
As much as they are now, almost. I think if they'd ended on Help, it would have been... Well, they had a good run. They did well. But if they ended on this one, I think it would have been so clear that the speed at which they were adapting things and absorbing things and synthesising things and challenging each other and challenging their competitors... I think even if they hadn't done anything else after this, this is such an exciting departure, such a way marker for what's to come, all sorts of different avenues of what's to come musically in popular music.
Yeah.
I think if they'd ended on this one, they would still be the Beatles as we know them.
Well, they've done six albums, obviously, in terms of UK releases, and I think, I might have got this wrong, 10 UK singles, and it's just, would it be 10? I'm just trying to work out. But it's roughly half, just under half the singles of the 22 UK singles. It'd be a phenomenal body of work.
Yes, unparalleled.
They would at least be compared to all the other ones that are the stellar, you know, storied history bands and artists.
Yes, indeed.
I'm pausing to think, because given they are on the level of the altar, I'm just pausing.
It is difficult. I mean, it's fruitless and pointless, but it's nice to speculate. But I think Girl is one of the ones that makes me think that. It's such a leap in terms of what he was prepared to express.
I know.
And the palette he had, or the you know...
Now, I'm just going to say, we've got next I'm Looking Through You, but after that we've got In My Life, and maybe we could just do In My Life first and then go back to the other one.
Let's do that, because it's
because
companion piece to that. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, yes, you can tell us about... How do you feel about In My Life?
Well, I kind of don't know what to say about these songs, really, because I revere them, really, in a way. And they're so important in the history of the Beatles and Lennon and where he is.
Yeah.
How he has transcended the way he has been writing, the influence of Dylan, and given all that's going on, how he's maturing. I'm just staggered, really, in a way. And even was, you know, I've listened to these tracks thousands of times nearly, and still listening to the second side this morning, it leaves me speechless.
Yes, it's magnificent. And it was a kind of thought exercise at first, wasn't it? He started famously writing down place names.
That's right.
One of the first times that Penny Lane sort of popped into
their
thoughts.
That's right.
And isn't it funny how they're talking nostalgically as if they're old men now.
Because looking back, he throws nearly all this away. Yeah.
Yes, but really this is a place that he was hanging about 2 or 3 years before. It's not that long ago, but he's got this ancient weight of experience and knowledge and hindsight in a 25-year-old man. And it's not put on, it's genuinely there. And... So he tried writing kind of like the bus ride, I think, didn't he, from Menlove Avenue into town, and then rejected that. At some point recognised it is still a Beatles song, there better be a love element, there better be a personal element, and that's not cheap, it's a really good thing. In My Life, I Love You More is the perfect denouement of that. That's the only point in looking back on things, I think, is to recognise, well, actually, things have been great and wonderful and I have lost things, but I still have this. That's a positive thing. It is absolutely remarkable. George Martin's ding 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 thing is beautiful. That's him being the fifth Beatle without any kind of challenge, really, isn't it?
Well, he is.
And one interesting thing about In My Life is the melody, which I think is controversial.
That's right, because Paul's role in it.
Paul has claimed it largely, And that is kind of backed up by this received wisdom that Paul was the melody man and John, like those kind of street linear things.
And there's even been things like AI intelligence of it, of it, yes, and that shows a bit of it is definitely Paul, but yeah. Then a large part of it is also, you know, John.
Yes.
And do you think, in context, given you wrote all these lyrics, is there a pathway in terms of John's evolution from In My Life to Strawberry Fields?
Oh, definitely, yes.
So does he, that's parked in the back of his head? And
I think so.
Yeah.
I think maybe musically and just personally, he was on this trip to goodness knows where. They were all four of them headed for, you know, parts unknown, really. Nobody had really forged the trail that they were forging.
Yeah.
So it's not unnatural to start thinking back to when things were a little bit more secure. And In My Life was a kind of... They had all taken acid by this point. It's worth pointing out. Yes. And again, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we respect you as adults to make your own minds up about mind-expanding substances. But it hadn't really taken hold the way it was going to.
Yeah.
It had that initial mind-expanding effect on them as described by John and George both.
Yeah.
Paul, a wee bit cagier, but I think it's now accepted he had actually had it by that point. I think he had it with Tara Brown, didn't he? The Guinness millionaire who then blew his mind out in a car.
Yeah.
So there's a greater degree of introspection. By the time Strawberry Fields comes along, he's a year later and several thousand acid trips older. And it's no longer reflective introspection. It is cosmic introspection. It's kind of, where does this fit in the scheme of all creation and all the universe? And it's so much more... It's almost less generous to the audience, Strawberry Fields, because it is so internalized. It's so much John's head trip. Whereas In My Life is something I think most folk can relate to.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a more kind of relatable tune and sentiment.
I'm just again words, you know, but aghast, amazed that John Lennon. One of the conventional views of people like cultural historians, contemporary historians, is that John Lennon was this lazy so-and-so who didn't try very hard, had this like gift genius just, you know, fell to him. And then at points, you know, he's out there kind of like, you know, with Cynthia, kind of alienated, then he's out his face on drugs and doesn't try very hard. But I mean, that ridiculous view, when you think of what, when he did obviously face the issues of being alienated and he was off his face on drugs for a period, the body of work he produces before eventually, obviously, heroin dependency gets him at the end of the Beatles, it's just like, that just counters that completely, that view.
Well, he was hardwired to synthesize every experience creatively.
Yeah.
I think that was, it was just, I don't think he set out to do it. I don't think it was, he didn't wake up in the morning and say, how am I going to do this? It's a vocation. And it's, some people are like that, you know, this is how we understand the world. We process it. It turns into something new in our heads. And then we need to share that so that we can gain some kind of understanding or common ground with those outside people who aren't us, sort of thing. So yes, he was incredibly driven in that regard, I think, to work things out through this medium that was
And looking to a void in a sense that also included himself.
Yes.
And even make himself into a void through the use of drugs and other things. So I'm just mindful of time. We're just going to briefly go back. As I said, we would. I'm Looking Through You is the track before In My Life. What do you think of that?
A bit of a throwaway one, but I think one of the ones that's most closely aligned to maybe the country rocky birdsy sound that was coming out of the States.
Yeah.
The Birds got a 12-string Rickenbacker having seen George play one in A Hard Day's Night, didn't they? Mm. I think Roger McGuinn or Jim McGuinn as he was then. And then that cross-pollination bounced back because they lived on Tambourine Man and Turn, Turn, Turn by 65, I think, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and that was very sunshiny pop. And
they've hit number one with Mr. Tambourine Man even in the UK before.
Right, yes. So there's a lovely conversation going on, which is not as celebrated as the one with Brian Wilson, but it's certainly significant.
It's a revolutionary sound, basically.
It is. And it's another one that's Paul not being terribly generous to his other half, but doing it in a jolly way. Well, things aren't going great. Let's have another knees up about that then, which I just, you know,
He also did want to be, I mean, I've thought, like, you know, what's people following the Beatles, the McCartney-Jane Asher relationship, which we really, in a way, don't know the heart of, because, interestingly, they've not talked about it. And Jane Asher, I think, quite famously, has not talked about it at all, really.
Never
in years since. It's a five-year relationship. It's the formative years of his life. He does, in a way, he is... wanting the best of both worlds here, because it's a bit like I'm Mr. Entitlement, I am the Beatle, a Beatle, you know what, etc. But he is getting so much from Jane Asher and the Ashers, apart from a loving relationship. He's getting this whole access into high culture and, you know, high society and all sorts.
And to say, to sing Why Tell Me Why Will You Not Treat Me Right when she'd been putting him up for 4 years. She'd been
Fred housing.
Yes. Did Jane's mum do the French line for Michelle? Did she translate?
Well, that's a good question.
I think it was her. You know, they certainly, Paul's introduction to the avant-garde and the underground art scene was massively through them. And also talking kind of medical texts and things with Jane's dad, a very high sort of high octane conversation going on in that house.
I know.
He owed her a huge amount. I think we could be unfair and take his songs too literally actually as well, because I know as a songwriter, sometimes if you get a groove, the groove just drives it, and it doesn't, and you sort of, it's, the song is not really about the lyrics, the song is about the feel and the...
Yes.
So I don't think he wanted everybody to get up in arms and get cross with Jane Asher by any means.
No.
I'm sure he didn't.
No.
It was just, I want to write a ding, ding, good, or it's not, how does it start? It's a bit, it does start a bit like that. What goes, no, sorry, not what goes on. I'm looking through you. It's another kind of ding, ding, good, ding, 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 a bit like the word. Can't remember, that's terrible, I heard it this morning. But yeah, not my favourite track on the album by any means.
Okay,
but
so we're going to the last three tracks. You've got it's the third last track, you've got Wait.
Yes.
And I just being honest, I haven't again played it just recently. I think this is about filler.
Yes, I think so.
It's a little pause before the crescendo towards the end, and then obviously there's the false end in the sense of, like, you know.
Yes. Sonically, it's got that kind of feedbacky outro, brown, 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 which is probably quite new. I like it fine, but yeah, it's not. Yeah. I never find myself singing it, I don't think, and it's.
I'm happy to hear it in the context of this album,
yes.
You know, and but I often forget about it, you know,
sure,
when I'm
yes.
not on the album one. I generally go about my life forgetting about the track Wait.
Yes. I think the line, I've been good as I can be, is a bit disingenuous sometimes, the way they conduct themselves in relationships, but yeah.
So I'm just going to whiz us along.
Go ahead.
Because we've got two tracks left and we may have... So we've got the second George track, If I Needed Someone.
Yes, and it's a much cheerier one. And it's a lovely, 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 lovely song, this.
Oh,
it's a lovely sentiment too, and it's not a usual one. It's quite a unique take. If I Needed Someone, you know.
Yeah.
It's not too committal. It's not dismissive. It's... I think it's really lovely and musically lovely, and that dang dang dong, that really big kind of jangly, that's very Birdsy as well, isn't it?
It is.
Probably is the 12 string he had.
Yeah. And I cannot remember for me, just are both of these tracks on the dreadful Best of George Harrison from 1976 that had the Beatles tracks on it? I just can't remember.
Almost certainly, I would think.
Either both are or one of them, but I just can't remember.
Right.
And you know, that was all controversial because they were underselling his solo career, but. I've known these tracks as a little lad, and all the two George tracks, I always loved them.
Yes, I think it's gorgeous, and it's more upbeat than, and he wouldn't write another one this cheerful. Till Here Comes the Sun.
You don't think Piggies is cheerful?
No, although I don't hate Piggies as much as some folk do, because again, when I first heard it, it was just it was an uncritical child hearing, and I liked the harpsichord sound. And I knew what pigs were, so, you know, I understand this. So I don't mind it. But I think this one is lovely. If I Needed Someone, I think it's a genuine... He's such a... With his wide-eyed desire to just be totally frank all the time, he's an innocent in some ways, George. And this is another kind of very, very open, but him open in a more gentle and kind of connected way than... finger-wagging, stern, admonishing way.
It is true as well. As George developed, the palette of George's songs on Beatles albums really adds something to not just being Lennon, McCartney's
Definitely,
like,
yes.
who's top dog or who's singing, you know, the most covert way about themselves.
Yes.
I think he really adds something
character-wise.
Yeah, character-wise.
Spice-wise,
yeah.
The flavour. Well, we won't spend a huge amount of time on the last track, I don't think. So when we dispense with Run For Your Life, let's think of the album as a whole package then, as a whole kind of, think of it as a meal, like a palette of like all the different flavours in there.
Right, fessing up, right?
Yes.
When I first heard Run For Your Life, and by heard it for years, you know, I never listened to it that closely.
No,
I just sang along thinking it's a jolly little track.
Same.
Somehow, somewhere, or it was pointed out to me, I listened to it, and I thought, God, it's one of the dark Beatles tracks. It's not very progressive, to put it mildly.
Yes, but you wouldn't put it as the first track on a Beatles compilation to introduce someone to the band, would you?
Or say you say, anyway, people used to do mixtapes to people that were interested in of the opposite or the same sex.
Yes.
You wouldn't put it on that.
That's right. Unlikely to, no. It'd be sending a strange message. So it's important to note it was inspired by a line in an Elvis Presley
that's
song.
Right,
it's not an original idea of John's to seek out his, to eventually seek out his unfaithful girlfriend. But it does speak of a part of his nature that he was quite frank about in future interviews.
Yeah.
When, as we will come on to in a future episode, he began to learn about feminism and understand about the unpleasant aspect of some of the masculine roles that people were expected to fulfil.
I find this is one of the significant missteps of the album.
Mm.
And I think it's not just a misstep as a song, it's a misstep in terms of the suite of songs.
Yes.
And what's interesting is I think that George Martin and the Beatles, up until Help, produced, they're nearly faultless in how those songs are put together as suites of songs.
Yes.
The album's up to Hard Day's Night. I think Help there's some problems with.
Mm.
And I may have got this wrong memory-wise, but I think maybe Help ends with Dizzy Miss Lizzy or something.
It does, yeah. After Yesterday, it comes in straight after Yesterday.
No, okay, it's an attempt to do a twist and shout crescendo, but given you've got all these original compositions, it's a strange one to end with. Looking back,
it's not a great recording either. It's pretty messy.
No, and this is mistimed for a number of reasons.
That is one way to look at it. May I present another way to look at it? You can't end every album with A Day in the Life or Tomorrow Never Knows.
No, that's true.
Or even with
Good Night.
They went from this album to monumental album closers, to mind-altering album closers.
True.
This one, I think, if we can go onto the idea of it as a whole palette, as a whole kind of meal, if you wish, this is the mint at the end, which is not really part of the whole meal. It's not really connected to anything else you've eaten. It's just the, right, we've done that now. That was a good thing. Off we go. So I don't think, we could argue about the lyrics and things like that. They're fairly lamentable, really. They're not good. It's not good writing particularly.
No.
But in terms of a performance, it's a perfectly decent, upbeat, rocking, and it's a fairly memorable tune. I first came across it with my brother playing it on the piano, funnily enough. My oldest brother had the Beatles' complete music book, and he was playing that. So that one ended up fixing a hole for some of the first memories I have of the Beatles and not knowing who they were, but my brother playing these tunes. But yeah, so not a brilliant tune, not in anyone's top 10. But in terms of the whole balance of the album, what would have been a better closer? I don't think you want a portentous...
You wouldn't have wanted the word as the end. I mean,
maybe the word would have been lovely to close on.
Or is it too, like, practically anticipating Flower Power and Carnaby Street and that, explosion and implosion?
Well, it is, but nobody knew this at that point, did they?
No, they didn't. They would have been ahead of the curve, even more than they were ahead of the curve.
Because this album also anticipates the adoption of Indian instrumentation and Indian musical styles into Western pop. It also
the front cover again is another leap. You know,
they bent
the image,
and they don't have their name on the cover.
That's right.
Which was brand new, and they look like the four coolest human beings who've ever existed.
And as you think about these things, and I think this is one of the great things about the Beatles, is the micro histories you can get into and the micro stories, because it is a kind of endless source of things.
Yeah.
But I never realised till thinking about this coming up to today and our discussion was that the Rolling Stones daily, when their first UK album came out, they didn't put their name on the front cover.
Did they not?
They dared not to do that.
Right.
And that, on that front, They were several albums ahead of the Beatles.
Well, that they get
one point for that.
What's the score? 1 to 40,000. I was going to mention the Stones actually, because even when Paul, even in the more kind of maybe slightly regrettable relationship songs like Looking Through You, if you compare it to Under My Thumb, they're positively romantic and understanding, So,
and that's 66. That's when not that there's any excuse at any point, but they're well into knowing their craft and what they're saying.
Yes.
And take responsibility
that's
for your words.
Yes. So even Run For Your Life is not as bad as Under My Thumb, because Run For Your Life, I think it's the mitigating circumstance of Run For My Life is it sounds to me like a very vulnerable, weak man. It doesn't sound like a strong person who's about to go and commit a crime. It sounds like a desperate, broken, weak man, which John later more or less confessed to having been, really.
Yeah.
Whereas Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones sounds like a cocky, arrogant, middle-class wanker, for want of a better word, bragging about the fact that he is engaging in coercive behaviour with his girlfriend, which it's unbearable. I can't stand it. So I expect a lot of angry letters from all the Stones fans. But
yeah, I think my feeling about this album is, having known it, you know, most of my life, you know, and knowing the Beatles' work most of my life, I mean, I can't really imagine what the world would be like without the Beatles. It would be so much less interesting and less a kaleidoscope.
Yes.
In the chronology, this A Hard Day's Night is a magnificent jump.
Yes.
But this is the first album, you know. It feels, even allowing for, I think, you know, the Run for Your Life point, it does feel like a set of songs recorded as an album. Mm. And the fact they did this, 14 songs in this short period for the Christmas market, they're working absolutely to the clock. And they also produced, as we were referencing earlier, on the same day released, Day Tripper, We Can Work It Out. I think it's the first ever A-side,
double A-side
yes. single in UK. And now, again, because we understand more and more things about that, that becomes a double A-side because the power in the group's shifting.
That's right.
The Beatles are Lennon's band, and then he agrees to let Paul come in and become a member. He knows he's taking a risk with that, but he knows he can do greater things with this force, which is obviously it turns out to be beyond their wildest dreams.
Yes.
But this is, Lennon wants Day Tripper as the A-side, and it doesn't get his way.
That's right. And I think, certainly in the States, We Can Work It Out was much more popular. It went to number one, I think. Did Day Tripper, I don't know what the chart positions were in the UK.
Well, it's just together.
Are they together?
They were split in America, the A and B sides, or double A's.
Okay.
So in the UK, it's number one. But I think from memory, because there's different charts, on the main chart, it comes at number two to begin with, and then goes to number one. Mm. As also it happens with Paperback Writers subsequently in the following year. And there's a view that, the Beatles, that there's a, you know,
They're only going in at number two these days.
That's right. And sales are maybe slowing slightly, you know.
Yes.
But of course, that's not how it turns out subsequently.
No, but that point, so the shifting kind of power structure in the band really became problematic for John after he lost his ego through acid. I think it's, without wishing to be too simplistic, you know, he deliberately undermined his own self-esteem to some extent chemically, and it probably didn't help that at the same time, Paul was hitting his stride, and Paul McCartney's stride is something to behold. But at this point, this is the one where I think John is still being equally energised and delighted by the competition. He's not ceded the high ground yet. It's still his band, but it's much more a band of equals. And even George's status coming up with two substantial songs on the album.
That's right. And Ringo's got one third of a song.
Ringo's got a third of a song. So I think this is the encapsulation of almost everything that was brilliant, both about their early period and their late period. And I don't think you can say that about many of the other albums.
It's not a transitional, it is a transitional album, because it's the album where they're taking off to go somewhere else.
Yes.
And they're off the runway, and it's somewhere wonderful on its own. Like, we're going to a lovely holiday destination.
Yeah.
But they're a way to go somewhere else, even more exotic.
Mm.
And in that, the power dynamics are a way to change even more in Revolver and subsequently.
Yes.
And John, in a sense, is then loses his place and loses his sense of self, I think.
He does, yes.
Which is, you know, it's all well documented. In fact, you know, there's lots of studies written on this.
Yes, indeed.
But this is critical of this album. And it's you don't need to know any of that. It's just joyful music.
Well, that is it. And I do worry that there's a... It's a very blokey thing to do, isn't it? I love it. I mean, we very clearly love it. But really, I would hate to think anybody would be listening to this podcast rather than listening to the album. You know, go and listen to the album.
Well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I've got things to do today as well. Everyone. But at some point today, I'm going away to go, and after our discussion, listen to that album again.
Oh, yes. I think I might do the same.
After erudite and more musically informed insights than my own.
Oh, well, great. Good stuff.
Because it's given me new... it's clearly true you can overanalyze things, and that's one of the issues about deadly serious musicology.
Mm.
But a small amount of musicology with passion and, you know, love can be a good thing.
Yes.
And I'm energized after listening to it this morning to later today go and listen to it again.
Fantastic. It rewards repeated listens.
Yeah.
And we don't have time now to go to the rabbit hole, but you've got multiple different options to listen to, don't you? Because you've got various...
Well, I do, but we've talked about it as well. I the whole thing about, yes, music nostalgia, and I maybe have at most sometimes like maybe half a dozen versions of different albums, and I sort of draw the line at that. I don't buy lots of box sets if I don't listen to them. Like, I never bought any of the big posthumous Miles Davis box sets. Of the multiple versions of this, obviously there's the American issue, which, just to mention, has 12 tracks and has 10 tracks from... Is it 10 tracks from this album? I'm just trying to... It's 10 tracks from this album, and is it 2 from Help?
A couple from Help.
Yeah.
I've just seen a face,
and It's All We Love. And that is the album that was viewed as more a folky album, because it opens with I've Just Seen a Face, that Brian Wilson and the Byrds and others were hugely influenced by. So that American issue, in a way... They're obviously ersatz, you know, false productions, these albums. But if you're an American kid growing up listening to a musician, those albums have a point to you, and that's why they've been reissued.
Yes.
Because they have a place in American popular culture, and that really matters in the story of the Beatles.
A very significant one. It was really that's seen as their folk album, and it's not really a folk album. I mean, a British understanding of folk would not allow you to call this a folk album, even the American kind of issue of it with the two more acoustic-y songs. But, yes, I always want to know what the band wanted for their albums, and the British canon is what they came up for.
Of course.
And especially at this point when they were clearly thinking in broad sweep and clearly thinking in kind of groups of songs, and almost like thinking about, you know, this is our blue period. You know, they had that kind of bigger picture in their heads at this point and what was possible. And I think with this album, they achieved what was possible. Yeah.
I do think of their early albums up to Rubber Soul as them fully blossoming in terms of... I regard this an album of somehow of colour. And, I mean, A Hard Day's Night is obviously black and white in the sense of black and white. Help is a colour film, but it doesn't feel completely fully vivid in a full sort of spectrum of colour.
No, not musically, no. No. I mean, the film is very knockabout, silly, colourful fun, but...
But this still sounds, in a way, as I was saying earlier, just as we're concluding, you know, repeating myself, it sounds both of its period, and it still sounds like vibrant and, in a sense, saying something, or not now, but universally.
Yes. I mean, I think that
that's a great thing of brilliant music.
Yes, absolutely. It's still an album that any band would give their right arm and right leg to come close to, I think. Really.
Well, Oasis certainly never will.
No, they won't. And I say that with affection for Oasis. I don't think they would claim to be able to either, that because they haven't got the palette, the variety, or the imagination, perhaps.
Of even Pulp or Sweat or some of those other bands you referenced there.
No, that's right. Try as they might.
So have you got anything else you'd like to say about Rubber Soul as we conclude?
I think not, but why don't we consider, do we want to give a quick prelude of some of the things we might talk about in this series? Because we've got...
Yes, we've got many. Well, we're going to talk about, for one, the joy and wonder that is Ringo. I think he is more and more... He used to be quite underappreciated and patronised and so on, but I think he's more and more being seen as just brilliant drummer, critical to the Beatles, and his post-Beatles journey is even fascinating, although some of it's a bit messy, obviously.
Yes, but redemptive, which is...
Yeah.
A nice thing. There are plenty of tragedies in the Beatles story, and his is not one of them. So.
And what else have we got apart from Ringo, you think?
Did we discuss talking about John Lennon's introduction to feminism and John and Yoko together? I like the idea of looking at the unfinished musics albums, but I recognise that that's going to be a niche episode.
Well, I'm not upset and listening to them.
No,
I'm not in an episode anyway. I will do the research.
I don't think I'd be advocating for them on a musical front.
I think we also thought, as well as experimental John, we would do, which you may do at some point, as well as we do experimental Paul.
Oh, yes. Give him his credit for his delving into the avant-garde and the underground in London while living with the Ashers, largely, before he got his Cavendish Avenue place. It was then more interesting. So, yes.
And what we were thought of doing is that if there are future series, which is obviously dependent on a whole host of things, is...
Primarily on whether people are enjoying
whether there's anyone out there.
Yes, yeah.
Or we're just speaking to ourselves, is we thought we'd do one Beatles album and maybe also then conclude, in terms of bookending it, one solo Beatles album and maybe one of the less... Like, not Ram initially or Imagine or All Things Must Pass. And we thought maybe we would do one from 1979.
We did. And one perpetrated by Mr. Paul McCartney and his new band, Wings, the final Wings album, Back to the Egg,
yes. And that's an album I bought on the day of release and I've always loved.
Which is great, and it's one that I didn't even know existed until lockdown when I decided finally to see whether folk were telling the truth about Wings or whether they were actually quite good, and they are good. So, yes. So that's us, folks. If you managed to last this long, thank you very much. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you were listening to this on Spotify, it is also available visually on the YouTube if you want to see our cheeky wee faces as we discuss these things. I think enhances things, don't you, Jerry?
Well, I think adds another dimension, yes. And, you know, are you Eric or are you Ernie?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll be Eric. Okay. Right, great. So, thanks, folks. See you next time.